from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The Climate Change Summit is wrapping up in Copenhagen at this moment, but it's still not clear what's been accomplished. President Obama spoke to the gathering earlier today, but reaching any kind of agreement appears to still be stalled over the issue of transparency, whether or not China will allow verification of its carbon-reducing efforts. We'll get the latest from Copenhagen and the Climate Summit, hear what's been resolved and what hasn't, on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Earlier today, a stern President Obama took to the stage at the Climate Summit in Copenhagen, urging the assembly that time was running short. But at this hour, it's still not clear whether the world's leaders will accomplish anything or leave Denmark empty-handed. The talks have been contentious to date, more so than anticipated. And in recent days, they seem to have stalled over the issue of transparency. The United States wants to make sure that carbon-reducing efforts by China and other developing nations are verifiable. Going to get the latest now on what's going on with Copenhagen as the summit comes to its close. Joining us, Rob Schmitz, Los Angeles Bureau Chief for KQED's California Report. He's been at the summit the past 2 weeks. Rob, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
And Craig Miller will be joining us in a bit as well. He's senior editor at KQED's Climate Watch Project. He'll be joining us from our studio in Sacramento. And also Stephen Schneider, climatologist and professor of interdisciplinary studies at Stanford University, also in Copenhagen this past 2 weeks. We'll be hearing from him in a bit as well. Rob, it's the end of your day there, but is it the end of the summit? At this point, has anything come together, or are you going to go on for a bit in sort of extra innings?
Well, I think that people are ready for extra innings, but we're just getting word just minutes ago, actually, that there's word, at least throughout the halls here at the Bello Center, that world leaders will convene again in the plenary session today. And, it's 6 p.m. right now in Copenhagen, and world leaders have been here the entire day. Presumably, President Obama's been here speaking with the Chinese. China sent its premier Wen Jiabao here. He spoke this morning, and President Obama also had a brief speech this morning in which he basically hammered home that transparency would be kind of one of the sticking points. And here is what he said.
We must have a mechanism to review whether we are keeping our commitments and exchange this information in a transparent manner. These measures need not be intrusive or infringe upon sovereignty. They must, however, ensure that an accord is credible and that we're living up to our mutual obligations. Without such accountability, any agreement would be empty words on a page.
Obviously, President Obama there with some pretty tough words.
We're joined by Rob Schmitz this hour, California Report's bureau chief from Los Angeles, who's been at Copenhagen all week. Rob, you can tell from that tone that he was sort of stern. A number of reports this morning said he sounded impatient, frustrated. What's the overall tenor at this moment? There's word out from the AP that there's now a third climate agreement being circulated. Mm-hmm. Is there a sense that something still could happen, or is the sense really of one of frustration that this hasn't gelled yet?
I think it's difficult to know. This event is enormous. We had 120 world leaders here. We've got negotiators from all over the world. We've got close to 4,000 journalists. It's difficult to know what's happening because a lot of it's happening behind closed doors. We get these leaked draft texts and we get a word here that a conference is going to be scheduled, and then we see canceled press conferences abounding, especially today. So it's kind of difficult to follow, honestly, as a journalist. And of course, when the leaders speak, especially today, you kind of have to read between the words about what they're actually saying. President Barack Obama spoke this morning. He didn't even mention China, per name, but he actually, of course, he was, nodding towards China when he talked about transparency. It was interesting. After his speech, I went out and started talking to folks about their reaction to his speech. I was finding some Americans, and I found an academic. His name is Dr. Michael Dorsey. He's an environmental studies professor at Dartmouth. And he got a call from Barack Obama a few years ago and was tapped to be an environmental advisor to him during his campaign. And he said that if he heard this speech before, he made that decision, he wouldn't have done that in the first place. He was very disappointed by Obama's speech, and here's what he said.
For God's sakes, it's time to lead. It's time to not continue to be in a kind of a tail-chasing game with the Chinese and the Indians. If the Chinese and the Indians are not going to lead on this issue, the U.S. has to take and maintain its moral leadership on this planet and step away from that fold of pointing fingers and blaming them for not being involved in this. And let's lead and let's be serious and let's be real on this.
And again, that was Dr. Michael Dorsey from Dartmouth College. I think that sentiment that he just expressed is definitely felt among a lot of world leaders here today as well.
Rob Schmitz joining us from Copenhagen this morning. But again, Rob, to underline the headline, the latest word that you're hearing is that despite that frustration, despite that sense of impatience that we heard from both the president and the critic that you just played, that they're still going to get together and sort of roll up their sleeves one more time this evening?
Well, yeah. I mean, you've got 120 world leaders here. I would hope and I would expect that they didn't come here to say, "Oh, okay, we failed. Let's go home." I think that we will see some sort of agreement here. Now, I think the big question, though, is whether or not this agreement will satisfy NGOs, scientists, and the general public after it's announced. And we have time to pour through it and see what actually they agreed upon. We know that a legally binding agreement will not come out of this conference. We are expecting a political agreement that will set the framework for a legally binding agreement perhaps in the next year, perhaps at the next Conference of Parties, which is scheduled right now for November of next year in Mexico City.
We'll get some details on what that proposal might be like and whether or not it is, as you suggest, sufficient to satisfy the concerns of scientists and others in this regard. But before we get Craig Miller to chime in on that part of this, Rob, fill in a little bit more detail on this question of verification. It reminds me, of that old Ronald Reagan line, "Trust but verify." That we seem quite stalled on this question. Tell us the United States' point of view, why they're insisting on verification from the Chinese and others, and then why the Chinese are not willing to do that.
That's a good question. I think the U.S. wants this primarily because of China's stated commitment. I think that the U.S. wants to make sure that everyone is playing by the rules that they said they would play by. On the other hand, China has a history, of course, of being a little and rightfully so of being a little scared of having foreigners come in and basically auditing them or inspecting any kind of process that they're doing inside its borders. This is something that goes back way back in Chinese history, and of course I think that from their perspective they think that they're able to do this by themselves, that they can, as Premier Wen Jiabao said this morning, he said, we've been working on these types of commitments for a long time now, and we monitor them ourselves, and that should be basically good enough. He didn't say it in so many words, but that's basically was the gist of his speech. So I think that's basically the sticking point here between the U.S. and China.
And Rob, when President Obama and Wen Jiabao met this morning, their private meeting, did you get any sense of what came out of that? It was, it was this classic reporting afterwards that you read where it says from official spokesman types that it was constructive, quote unquote. Any more sense beyond that as to what constructive might actually mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I need to clarify. This morning, he didn't even meet with Wen Jiabao before his speech. Wen Jiabao was supposed to be there in the room with 20 other leaders and Barack Obama. And instead, he sent He Yafei, which is the vice Minister for Foreign Affairs, and that was seen by many as almost like a slap in the face. And, you know, Wen Jiabao was not there this morning in that room before both of those gentlemen gave speeches. Now, this afternoon, we're not sure if he was talking with him. We haven't heard that yet.
Oh, okay. The reporting that I've read was that they did have a separate one-on-one meeting, and Kevin Guillory, our producer, just brought in a note from the AP saying that they're scheduled to meet on a one-on-one once again later today. So we'll see what comes from that. Let's bring Craig Miller into our conversation. Craig is KQED's Climate Watch senior editor. His blog can be found at kqed.org/climatewatch. You heard Rob Craig describe the problem that we may indeed have something that comes out of this. No one wants to leave completely empty-handed. The question is whether or not it will really be anything substantive. Can you define what substantive would be? Is there a sort of threshold by which most people look at this question and say, that's actually going to tip us in the right direction? Anything less than that won't really do the trick.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a moving target, actually, because I think it depends on who you're asking, what their particular definition of substantive is. As you may know, there was a document leaked that was an internal UN science document earlier this week, kind of got leaked to the Associated Press, which basically said, you know, even if we come out of this with everybody agreeing to kind of what they indicated would be a baseline agreement, it's still not going to be enough to keep the general warming target of 2 degrees, it's going to put us on a path that will exceed that. And there are a lot of environmental groups speaking up today, not only with a disappointment in President Obama's speech, some pointing to a lack of leadership here, but also to say, look, you know, the IPCC, this is from a statement from the Center for Biological Diversity, saying the IPCC itself estimates that CO2 reductions of 25% to 40% below 1990 levels are needed by 2020 to avoid greater than 2 degrees warming. And it's not looking like, even if they come out of this with some kind of an agreement, it's likely to achieve that.
So, Craig, is it a bit like the parallel to the healthcare debate that's going on right now? There's some people who are arguing that if healthcare reform doesn't contain certain provisions, we ought to just tear it up and start over again, that sort of reform is worse than nothing, the Howard Dean sort of argument. Is there an equivalent on the environmental side by strong environmentalists that unless you get to certain levels, it's not worth anything?
Well, you're starting to hear more of that. We, on this very program a few days ago, we heard James Hansen of NASA come out and say he hopes that Copenhagen fails because it's setting us on a path to a cap and trade system, which is also where the California policy is leading us and where the regional Western Climate Initiative is leading us and where the pending national legislation in the U.S. is leading us. You're starting now to hear more voices coming out and saying, you know, maybe this cap and trade thing isn't such a great idea because it's an extraordinarily complex system which worked well for regulating sulfur emissions from utilities where you're dealing with, you know, a couple of hundred entities. But to try to get the whole country or the whole world under this umbrella and regulate that and not have people gaming the system is a very tall order.
Craig Miller, KQED's senior editor for our Climate Watch project. Rob, what's the sense of that in Copenhagen? Is there a feeling that still in all something is better than nothing? Or is there some sense, as Craig is describing it, that unless it's significant, we just had better start all over again?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. If you talk to delegates, then I think that you're going to get some is better than a little is better than everything here. But if you talk to the NGOs, which are now more or less not here because they're not allowed to come into the building anymore, and there are only very restricted rules about this. I think many of them are very frustrated that these commitments that have been made, like Craig was mentioning, are just not enough. They're simply not enough, and that this entire process has been a really big disappointment.
Well, let's talk about the process for a moment and what you've observed there. There seems to be this sense that things have not gone as well as expected, that it was more contentious, that people really thought that more progress would be made, which makes it sound like something was not estimated correctly, that whether it was on the United States side or others, that not enough pure advance work was done. What's your read on that?
Well, you know, we went into this conference expecting that there wouldn't be an agreement. But, you know, at the beginning of the conference, I think that hope kind of triumphs over all. And we had a lot of hope those first few days of the conference. And so I think that might have set the expectations, the beginning of this conference. And also, I think the sheer volume of participants here in Copenhagen also showed the world that this issue is really important and on the minds of so many people, so many organizations, and also so many media organizations, and also world leaders. I don't think we've seen this many world leaders in one place at the same time. I'm not sure. I haven't checked the record books, but you know, 120 heads of state and world leaders. That's a big deal.
And Rob,
so I think. Yeah.
Sorry to interject, but when you say an agreement wasn't expected from the get-go, you mean a binding treaty. There was hope that there would be some sort of at least loose political framework agreement that people could trout as at least an accomplishment. But there was never the expectation that we would come away with a done deal treaty. Is that the distinction you're making?
That is, yeah. I mean, when the agreement was made that there would not be a legally binding agreement at the end of these talks, but that hopefully a political agreement would be made by which we could then base a legally binding agreement on. But, you know, we have yet to see anything of that sort right now.
Craig, walk us through the differences then between where we're at now and where we were with Kyoto. That's, I think, not always well understood by all of us, actually, what Kyoto actually meant. It, of course, never made its way through our process here in the United States. But can you give us some sense of what's a treaty and what's not? You know, what's a political agreement and what's not?
It's a political agreement if you sign it. If you don't, it's not. And what happened in Kyoto, of course, is a number of nations did sign the protocol, but the two biggest players, the U.S. and China, did not. And when you have the two largest carbon emitters in the world standing on the sidelines, it's pretty hard to get anything done, because that's the nature of this whole carbon emissions problem, is that even with all, for example, that California has been doing and trying to put in place, that's great, but the carbon doesn't know any borders, and it's a global problem of carbon in the atmosphere. And if you don't have the biggest global players involved in it, you're not going to make much headway. Now, Kyoto was a protocol that is expiring, of course, and what Copenhagen was supposed to be was a convention to put in place something to replace or extend Kyoto and hopefully enlarge it with the inclusion of the U.S. and China. Right now, that's, as we're hearing, highly questionable that that's going to happen. They're going to do this again, of course, in Mexico City a year from now. And I think that probably the realists in the crowd right now would be looking for, if there's any sort of agreement, something that kind of punts the ball down the field to Mexico City and puts us in a kind of a holding pattern. But, of course, the more you keep punting the ball down the field, the more this problem of anthropogenic global warming is going to get away from you.
And anthropogenic meaning man-made.
Human caused. Right?
And Rob, is the sense that you've been there that this in the end really does just come down to the United States and China, that all the good intentions and higher standards that EU nations and others have set are in a sense side players in this final game?
I wouldn't call them side players. I think that they have a very big role in this entire process. This is the United Nations. But I think that the U.S. and China have considerable strength in a forum like this. They are large economic powers. They are the two largest emitters, and you know, they obviously have a lot of power in an international forum like this. So yeah, I think that what they agree on or don't agree on usually tends to kind of take the spotlight. And definitely took the spotlight as the 2 weeks here started winding down.
We've talked a little about sort of two of the three things that have been in contention during all this, what the actual standards would be that Craig was describing, this question of verification with China. The other question, Rob, has been this fund to help developing nations contend with the consequences of global warming. Secretary Clinton made the announcement this week that the United States would be supportive of developing this fund up to $100 billion a year by the year 2020, although the U.S. percentage of that $100 billion a year was left unclear. Why is that so critical to developing nations? And clarify, for example, who would be eligible for that, right? Because China would not be.
I'm not aware if China would not be. I think that that was a sticking point as well throughout these negotiations, and I don't know if that's been hammered out completely yet. I think that it's there. It's important for many countries, especially the poorest countries on Earth, to have some assistance, because many of these countries have not fully developed yet, and so they are being asked to also help with curbing their greenhouse gas emissions, and so they will need help with building a clean energy infrastructure in their countries. That's going to take a lot of investment, and that's going obviously going to take a lot of money. And so I think that it's really important for these countries to probably get a lot of this money, because they simply think that and this has been echoed throughout the halls here of the Bella Center, that look, the U.S. and all the powers of the world, the Western world, have had their chance to fully develop themselves. They burned a lot of carbon in the process. We haven't, and now you're asking us not to. We need help.
And is this – yeah, Craig, go ahead.
Just chime in a little bit on this $100 billion thing. I mean, this is to try to address this fundamental problem that Rob is describing of the developing nations saying, look, we'd like to be on board with something here, but you guys, the industrialized countries, caused most of this problem. You put most of that carbon up there. So you guys should pick up most of the tab for solving the problem. Now, this $100 billion number that was thrown out was one that was originally brought up by the United Kingdom as a kind of a test the waters kind of number for, okay, how much money would it take? You know, it's like the car dealer. Okay, what would it take, you know, for you to do this deal today? And it's not, by the way, an intention, as some have interpreted, that the United States would put up $100 billion.
Right.
What Secretary Clinton actually said was that we would – that the U.S. would support an international fund of up to $100 billion only if, by the way, something is inked at this conference in Copenhagen. And then since then, you've had some representatives of developing countries coming out and saying, well, that's nice, it's a start, but $100 billion is not enough.
And also only inked if there is an agreement on this question of verification, at least as I've understood the reporting coming out of the conference. But Rob, would you say that on this point, there's the most consensus, there's an agreement that there really does need to be this large fund for developing countries?
Oh, yes. Yeah, money was the big sticking point throughout these negotiations. So I think that's one of the it's possibly, you know, the most important element of this. When Secretary Clinton announced her support for a $100 billion fund yesterday, it definitely was a clear signal that, okay, well, it looks like they're working at least the financing of this out. Now let's go to the next sticking point. Of course, that was the transparency issue.
All right, we have to pause and take a break. When we return, we'll take your calls on this topic. We'll also give Rob 2 minutes to figure out whether or not anything has happened before we conclude the rest of our program. So, Rob, see what you can find out in the next 90 seconds or so. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And also, you can leave your comments on our website at kqed.org/forum if you'd like to participate that way. Email them to us as well at forum@kqed.org. Back with more on the Climate Summit. We'll take your calls, hear more from Rob Schmitz and Craig Miller about what's going on in Copenhagen after this. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the Climate Summit in Copenhagen, which is supposed to be wrapping up at this hour, but people are still scurrying about trying to put together some kind of at least loose political agreement, though not a binding treaty. Rob Schmitz has been circulating over the last 90 seconds trying to find out if anything is going on that we have not yet been able to report. Rob, have you found anything out?
Well, it looks like the Conference of the Parties plenary session is going to resume in about 15 minutes here. But negotiations, it said, would still be ongoing. I think there's probably some administrative matters that they have to settle before the end of the day today, since this is technically the last day of the conference. But it looks like I'm just looking at it right now. I'm sorry, but it looks like negotiations are still happening as we speak.
And Rob, who's participating in this last session that's now going to be starting soon?
Oh, in the last session, it'll be the delegations who represent each country, of course, at this conference, as well as the president of COP15, and I think it's mostly a lot of record keeping kind of things that they have to finish up.
But what about the world leaders who are still there, President Obama and others? Will they be at the table at this point? Tell us what they're doing.
No, they're behind closed doors right now, trying to hammer something out, I would assume, and I would imagine that they're here at the center talking about a lot of the sticking points that we've been talking about this morning.
Yep. Stephen Schneider joins us as well now. He's a climatologist professor for interdisciplinary environmental studies at Stanford University. He's been attending the Copenhagen Climate Summit for the last 2 weeks as well. Stephen Schneider, as we come to the end of this process, or perhaps not, perhaps it will extend on through the weekend, give us your sense of what you've observed, whether you have a sense of frustration at this point or whether or not you're still holding out hope that something will be worked out.
Well, having been in this business for about 39 years and having watched it switch from the left brain of a couple of hundred of us over the past 30, 40 years to now where it's in the right brain of the whole planet, that really is progress, but you have to be kind of my age to see it. It's very, very frustrating to deal with this issue from day to day because the scientific community has been almost single-minded. I'm talking about the real climate scientists. In saying that if you warm up more than another couple of degrees, then the number of systems that will be seriously impacted goes way up. Species extinction, sea level rises, this kind of thing. And we really have to start cranking this back. And the political world doesn't operate on multi-decadal things, what's for your kids, your grandkids, and the next generation, and the plants and animals. They are locked into local and short term. So it's a really tough translation for politics.
Right.
Fortunately, our president gets it, but he also is stuck with the midterm elections, and he's going to have to sit there and, in his own mind, I don't think he's going to get this from his advisors. He's going to have to make a decision to balance those interests in terms of how much compromise he can accomplish.
And give me the sort of science's response to those political objections. As you know, a bill passed in the House, hasn't passed in the Senate. The Republican leader in the House, John Boehner, said earlier today in terms of this global fund now to help developing nations contend with climate change. John Boehner said yesterday, "Let me get this straight. We have deficits as far as the eye can see, and the administration wants to give billions in U.S. taxpayer dollars to other countries. Give me a break."
Well, of course, I'm sure the good Republican leader forgot to mention who created the deficits, his president in the 8 years before that, and that they inherited a balanced budget. So I'm sure that will not be lost in the Democrats in the campaign. The thing that has scientists so frustrated is that we live in a tribe, if you will, for where people who describe a problem in a way where they select out of context particular bits of fact that help the client interest but that aren't balanced, for us that's dishonest. But in the world of advocacy, that's the daily bread. So it's really frustrating to scientists to watch a political process. In fact, most of them don't even want to play because we're the kind of guys who are toilet trained to lead with our caveats. We bury our lead, as the journalists say, and we're very ineffective in trying to counter these special interests who come along with an out-of-context fact and push, 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 push. And that's exactly what's going on. Unfortunately, the media tends to give equal status to all claimants when the scientists, in my opinion, are dramatically more credible than most of the deniers. But that is a very tough political debate. And if the public doesn't get it because they're getting so confused with one PhD says end of the world. And one says, good for you, by the way, are those two lowest probability outcomes. People are confused. When people are confused, they don't send consistent right. signals to politicians. And then the politicians regress to doing what the special interests want. And that's why it's so frustrating to scientists. Although it's doubly frustrating because we know that President Obama understands this problem.
Yeah.
I mean, he has phenomenal advisors. He really gets it. But he also has Rahm Emanuel reminding him about the political realities of looking like he's giving money to China and India. So it's a really, really tough bind for him to be in. And, well, it's, you know, it's in a way, it's a test of how he's going to juggle the short-term politics versus his own deep long-term belief in planetary sustainability.
Stephen Schneider, a professor for interdisciplinary environmental studies, climatologist at Stanford University. Craig, were you trying to jump in?
I'm sorry. I think I stepped on you there.
Yeah,
but
no,
I brought this up briefly before, but I didn't articulate it very well. And I'd love to get Dr. Schneider's reaction to this IPCC report that was leaked earlier in the week, essentially saying that even if fully realized, you know, the promises that have been made would still result in the CO2 concentrations above the point where we need to be. Of over 3 degrees Celsius.
And Professor Schneider, go ahead and respond to Craig's query if you would. But let's do it, if we can, sort of briefly, because I want to get to our listener calls and their concerns about what's going on in Copenhagen this morning, too. But Dr. Schneider, go ahead.
Okay. Sorry to be guilty of too much talk.
No, that's okay.
I do this all the time. yes, there's no question that we're going to overshoot a target that that gives us planetary safety. We will probably warm up at least 2 and maybe 3 or 4, and I'm talking Celsius degrees, if we keep on the track that we're on now. And we could, even if we keep going beyond that, warm up something like 6, catastrophic outcome in my personal view. So we've got to try to get this down. However, the good news is you can invent technology and deploy it over 1 to 2 decades. So if we really invest in green tech, and we get the private sector engaged, then we can, after this overshoot, start coming screaming off it at high speed by having invented our way out of the problem. So I have a fair amount of hope that we can, you know, pull this rabbit out of a hat. But the hat's burning, so we got to pull pretty fast. And it can be done, but we're still going to have some damages we can't avoid. The whole thing is you can't give up because of the water that's under the bridge. There's still plenty of water upstream. You got to stop the flood. So this is another step. In a way, it's a whirl and a long dance and a long dance card. We've been doing this for a long time. We're making progress. It's just much slower than the planet needs from the perspective of avoiding dangerous changes.
Stephen Schneider from Stanford University joining us from Copenhagen this morning, along with Rob Schmitz, the California Report's Los Angeles Bureau Chief, who's also been observing and reporting on the climate conference, and Craig Miller, our senior editor for the Climate Watch Project at KQED. Let's take your calls as well, your concerns, questions about what's happening or what's not happening in Copenhagen as of this hour. Todd joins us first in Sunnyvale. Todd, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if maybe an easier way to get this done is to start off something smaller, something kind of like a carbon-free trade agreement where people, essentially countries, opt in. And if you decide not to opt in, then you essentially have a sort of a carbon tariff put on you. But if you don't want that carbon tariff, then you join the agreement.
So sort of, Todd, sort of a variation of the cap-and-trade concept?
Yes, but it's like one of the sticking points I understand is that, you know, China, they get really upset when they talk about carbon tariffs or something like that. And I think that's one of the key things in trade to solve this problem, to have these sort of carbon tariffs.
Okay.
And so you get the option of either do it or don't.
Yep, Todd, thanks. Stephen Schneider, can you tackle that, please?
Well, I've always been an advocate, to tell you the truth, of a carbon tax where the revenue is recycled to A, the poor countries or our own poor, and B, toward those people who want to invent new green technology. And it was never a political starter because none of the politicians I could run into would utter the T word, in this case, tax. Now, tariff sounds a little nicer. I like to call it a sewer dumping fee. You know, we use the atmosphere like a free sewer to dump our tailpipe and smokestack waste. And people have accepted fees for that. But it's always going to get reframed as a tax. So I like the scheme, you know, the tariff scheme. You don't want to do an opt-in. But in a way, it's still what the economists call a shadow price on carbon, meaning there'll be some equivalent price, and whether you do it by tax, cap and trade, or tariff, in the end, it's going to cost more for energy, and it should, because energy is doing damage when you use the wrong kind of energy. So any of these schemes are going to help and move us in the right direction. But I don't know why. I mean, I do know why politicians are so afraid of saying tax.
Yep. Victor joins us next, San Franciscan, but in Copenhagen, calling us from Copenhagen this morning. Victor, go ahead. You're on.
Hi. I just thought you might want another update on what's been happening here in the last couple hours.
Well, we have our own man there reporting, Rob Schmitz, on that. But go ahead, Victor, if you have a quick observation.
Okay, I think I met Rob not long ago, wandering around the hall here. But the last couple hours, there's a draft from 2 hours ago that just came out. And it looks like they've come closer, the governments, in putting together a sort of a declaration deal, a very brief six-page thing. But I think that it still looks like what climate campaigners would call a greenwash.
Right. Victor, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the update on that. Rob, you were describing that draft earlier, that's come out. But is there any more specificity out there? Victor's commenting on the fact that people are frustrated because it doesn't get far enough.
Well, yeah, that's the main problem, I think, for a lot of NGOs and many folks in the environmental community is that. And also just for the UNFCCC, I mean, Ivo de Boer, you know, in the beginning of this conference wanted, 25 to 40% reduction in emissions from 1990 levels. And we're not seeing that at all. We're seeing much weaker commitments on the part of almost all nations. And so that's these drafts, we're not seeing that commitment to what was kind of a goal, I guess, by the organizers of this event.
Victor, thanks for the call from Copenhagen. John writes in, to use an old cliche, it seems Copenhagen has done little more than rearrange deck chairs on the Titanic. I'm as disappointed with the results in Copenhagen as I am with our own debate over health care reform. In both cases, the world is overinvested in methodologies and strategies that are ultimately harmful to the common person. Stephen Schneider, on this question, because we were talking about that before you joined us, is something better than nothing? It sounds like you're of the school of thought that we can't allow ourselves to be too frustrated and discouraged and throw up our hands and say, if I don't get what I want, I'm walking away, that even a little is better than nothing.
Well, it depends what the little is. If the little has the right structure, but it doesn't have big enough numbers, that I can live with for a short while. Remember the old expression? From the Middle East, which is don't let the camel get its nose under the tent, because before too long, the butt will be in there. If we can get the right structure, then you can crank up the knobs so you have a low target now, but you structure it with funds. You structure it with tens of billions of dollars spent on inventing green tech and deploying it. These things can enable us to meet targets, not 2020 much, but I'm not so worried about 2020. We have got to come way down by mid-century, and by 2030, we should probably be cutting at least 40%. I think we can do that. It's very difficult to do that by 2020, given where we are now. So let's get the technologies and the financing and the things in place. That won't be a total failure. However, cranking up those knobs, right? Why do you think the number of the Republicans and the Democrats in fossil fuel states are so hell-bent against any agreement at all? Because they know, get the nose in the tent, and soon there'll be some hurricane that takes out a major city. It changes the whole politics. Now you've got the structure in place to crank up the knobs to where we need to go. So I don't want to let the perfect, you know, what I'd love to see and been fighting for 30 years for, crowd out the mediocre. I mean, we're not even at good. So the perfect can't be the enemy of the mediocre. Remember, we've been going in the wrong direction at high speed for one or two decades. So we're making halting progress. I don't think we ought to kill it. We will really lose an opportunity if we insist that we have it all right now.
Here's another email along those same lines. Managing climate change is urgent, but even with the best possible outcome at any conference, the process of managing this problem has to last the rest of the lives of everyone listening to this program. Whatever happens in Copenhagen, despair is neither warranted nor helpful. It's one of the luxuries we have to realize we can't afford anymore. Happens to come from my nephew, who's writing from The Hague this morning. Thanks for that, gents. And Ted writes in, while the certainty of CO2-driven global warming is clear, the magnitude of the economic consequences does not seem as entirely certain. How much has the economy been talked about in all of this, Rob, in Copenhagen, that we know about the environmental consequences, we're not as sure about what the economic consequences will be?
Well, actually, you know, I think Dr. Schneider made a point earlier about green tech. You know, it's funny, you know, a lot of the businesses that, you know, and there are many businesses here and trade organizations. And I don't know if this gets to what you were asking about, but it's something I wanted to mention is that, you know, I spoke with members of the International Chamber of Commerce, and this is based in Paris. It's not the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and I think we know what where they've stood on some of these issues. But at the International Chamber of Commerce, at least, I was speaking to one of their main spokeswomen yesterday, and she said that, you know, the many hundreds of businesses in her organization want to see commitments from all countries here. They want to see an agreement because they want a stable price that's put on carbon so that they can start investing with some confidence. And I think that so you're seeing even the businesses here in Copenhagen and I think all around the world that would like to see an entire economic system begin with a stable market. And, you know, I think that's another thing that we need to think about when we think about what's going to come out of this conference.
And of course, you can interpret the question about economic consequences any number of ways. You can think of it in terms of the T word that Professor Schneider was mentioning before, that if we tax up things, that will have mm-hmm. a hard economic consequence. On the other hand, if you look at it from the economic consequence of an island nation that may well be flooded 30 years from now, that's a pretty acute economic consequence as well. So as it all comes back, as you've said before, Rob, on sort of your point of view on all of these things, and that has to be what's most difficult about hammering together some kind of agreement. Let's go next to Paul in San Francisco. Paul, go ahead.
With respect to everybody at your panel, I was going to say about the damaging the atmosphere. There are a lot of pipelines being exploded in Georgia, Iraq, Turkey, and Nigeria. What kind of effect do these things have, especially when they burn for 2-3 consecutive days? And back in 1990, even Saddam Hussein let them burn for 1 month. What kind of damage do they do to the atmosphere when they get up there? Thank you very much. I take my answer offline.
Paul, thanks. Professor Schneider, put that in any kind of context for us, those kinds of long-burning fuel lines?
Yes, they were very, very serious air pollution problems that, you know, went into the lungs of the people who breathed it and particles and so forth. It was a trivial problem from a climate point of view, because when you look at the billions of tailpipes in this world and smokestacks and fires out there, they totally swamp that in terms of the total amount of carbon dioxide. It's a symbol that's important. Can I just clarify one thing about the tax thing you mentioned?
Yeah.
I didn't say that the tax would be economically harmful. I said it would be politically harmful.
Right.
Because if you look at the total costs that everybody is talking about here, and the kind of numbers are in the hundreds of billions of dollars a year to fix this problem for the next 20, 30 years, and that sounds astronomical. But when you think about it, it isn't even close to astronomical. Because the world economy is $50 trillion, right? That's 1,000 times more than a billion. And the economy, except for the last year in the recession, was growing more than 2% per year. So assuming it's coming back at 2% per year, that means at 50, you know, at 50 trillion, we've got $1 trillion added to the world economy every year. And we're talking about spending 20, 30% of it, of the growth rate. So we're all getting richer. And what are we getting to that? Planetary sustainability and a safer world for our children, grandchildren, and a home where nature can survive. It's cheap insurance, in my personal view. And people have entirely misframed this problem as some kind of economic catastrophe. It is an economic catastrophe for certain industries like coal. So they know it. They're organized. But the new jobs that will come out, those people don't know it and aren't organized to realize that they're getting a benefit. And the economic studies show that it really is not expensive relative to growth rates of the economy. It just sounds big because most people don't know billions from millions, let alone trillions.
Fair enough. And Craig Miller, you wanted to add in something. Go ahead, Craig.
I was just going to make the point that you don't have to be an island nation either to have a lot at stake here. I mean, there have been reports that there are $2.5 trillion worth of assets just within California at risk from the effects of climate change, combination of rising sea levels, fires, and so forth. And that's about – that figure's about double the state's gross state product of California.
Here's a question, Stephen Schneider, perhaps you can respond to this too, because again, this has to do with keeping things in context. As the earlier caller referenced the question about burning fuel lines in Iraq and Turkey and elsewhere, this person wants to know about the consequence of carbon from wood burning used for cooking in nations such as India and China. I'm not sure, this person writes, Hussam writes, I'm not sure if this carbon is taken into account. Can you clarify what that is? So again, help us put into context what's really the problem and what isn't.
Now, remember that the carbon in that wood came out of the air. It was CO2 in the air, and photosynthesis put it into the tree. So as long as you let the tree grow back, you don't have any net carbon injection in the atmosphere. So the key then is not to deforest permanently, because if you do that, then the amount of carbon that was in the standing stock of the trees gets in the air. And we know that about 20% of the carbon dioxide emitted in the last century came from deforestation. But the primary deforestation numbers do not come from fuel wood. It basically comes from clearing land. You know, Brazil did it, and clearing land for grazing in Brazil or for oil palm in Borneo and in other parts of Asia and Africa. So the really big numbers come from that massive land clearing and industrial scale grazing and oil palm activities. So yes, these little wood bits matter, but they're really down at the bottom end of the total. It's the large-scale operations that do most of the damage. And these large-scale operators are all organized and putting tremendous pressure on the national governments not to give them on anything because they want to maintain market share. It's really about that kind of special interest. And when those special interests are powerful and have a large part of national economies, it starts dominating those countries' views of the long-term sustainability of the planet. And a lot of us do not forget to let them know that they're making that trade-off.
Hmm. Let's get in one more caller this hour. Ralph in San Jose is next. Ralph, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to point out that there's far too many people focusing on technical solutions to a lot of these problems. And the first thing you should always do is focus on getting more efficient. And those don't require large changes necessarily. Sometimes it does, but in people's lives. I mean, people can make small changes and become much more efficient in their consumption of energy, much more efficient in how they use fossil fuels, much more efficient in how they produce carbon, produce much less carbon. And, technical solutions are always a double-edged sword. I mean, that's been true throughout history, and then people put far too much trust in technical solutions.
Ralph,
and the other thing I wanted to point out
go ahead.
Is just all of the energy, all of the fossil fuels that we use is actually solar energy, and it's been accumulated over the last 3 billion years, and we're past peak oil now, so we've burned through basically more than half of the easily reachable stuff in the last 100 years, more or less. Then the curve of use is, of course, accelerating, so that's both good and bad. It's bad in the sense that we're using much more at a much more rapid pace, but it's good in the sense that people are going to be forced to make changes because that, as a source of energy, is going to disappear.
Ralph, thanks. have to hold you there, but thanks for the observation. We're actually going to devote a future program on the individual things that people can do. It's a useful reminder. Thanks for that. Let's go around once on where we're as it's approaching the 7 o'clock hour in Copenhagen, Rob and Sneve Schneider. Any further sense as to what we can come away from? And perhaps as importantly, if we don't come away with anything terribly concrete, what your thoughts are on where this conversation will go next as we proceed. Rob, a quick last thought, please.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm seeing on the screen right now there will be no COP15 family photo today. And so, you know, this is
COP15, tell us what that acronym means.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, Conference of Parties. That's what that's what this conference is called. So there's no family photo. It's been canceled. So it's sad, and at the same time I have to believe, or I have to wonder, you know, there are these world leaders here. I think that there will be an agreement. I'm not sure, though, like I said before, that it's going to satisfy much of the folks that really do care about this issue, and it definitely is a big issue.
And Stephen Schneider, just a quick last thought, please.
Well, was it Yogi who said it ain't over till it's over? I mean, remember, there's a lot of pressure on these politicians. They also think, I'm talking about the leaders, they think about their place in history, too.
Yeah.
Amazing how that gives you a little extra push. And I'm hoping that we'll get that. We will not get near where we need to be. But if the structure is good, don't let up. You've got to keep going. You've got to go to the next one. You've got to get it done. We've got to get it done in the U.S. Congress. And these things will come together as long as we can maintain some support between the president, the Congress, and the public. And we've got a lot of work to do in the public because they've been so misinformed by this fraudulent climate denier gate. And there is a lot of work that we've got to do in the next year to make it more politically acceptable, so the political leaders in the U.S. at least will not feel so threatened by having some courageous stance on climate policy.
Stephen Schneider, professor of interdisciplinary and environmental studies at Stanford University, and appreciate your comments and joining us this hour, and appreciate your use of useful analogies from camels under the tent to baseball and Yogi Berra. That helps make all of this clear. Craig Miller, you're trying to make things clear, of course, on your Climate Watch blog. What are you going to be tracking as we come out of Copenhagen? Quick last thought.
Fighting cliche with cliche, I hear the fat lady singing in Copenhagen right now. I don't expect much from this. I think we should start looking toward Mexico City.
And a reminder to all of us who are participating in our program, if you'd like to continue this discussion, we've added a comment section now on our website. So if you'd like to add and continue this conversation about where we go next, you can do so online at kqed.org/forum. Visit that site and continue the conversation there. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lorberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, our engineer, Danny Bringer, and the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.